Please turn in your Bibles to Matthew 19, beginning in verse 3. We'll read from that shortly. While you're turning, may I say that we're going to begin this morning a series on marriage and the Christian home. The elders ask that I spend considerable time on that this year, and in accord with their desire, this series is being presented, and I commend it with all that I have in me as being the message of the time. Brethren, we're living in a crisis age. It's not confined to locality or to the local scene. It's confined to the world, but it's expanded especially in our attention to the national. We're living in times of a national crisis. In 1964, I did some research on marriage and divorce and found that in the year 1960, there were 400,000 divorces granted in America in that year. Then later on, I learned that in 1971, there were 768,000 divorces granted in that year. And then in 1974, there were 970,000 divorces granted in 1974. The estimate for 1975 is that there will be over 1 million divorces granted in the last year, 1975. And when those figures come out, I'm confident that the figure will exceed 1 million. So that's the kind of crisis time that we're living in today. In the light of these statistics, you might want to ask, well, what are my chances then for having a successful, happy home? Well, if you're leaving it up to chance, I would suggest that probably your chances are about 1 out of 4. For every 4 marriages, and this is a conservative figure, for 1 out of every 4 marriages ends in divorce. For every 1 marriage that ends in divorce, another one ends in separation, and still another one is kept together for various reasons, and yet that marriage is unhappy. And out of the 4, there is probably 1 that results in a happy, well-adjusted, successful marriage. But if you're not leaving it up to chance, if you're willing to contract your marriage on the basis of Christian principles, there's every reason to believe that your marriage will be healthy and happy, that it will be successful and rewarding. And I urge you to think seriously about it. The prospect is not something that's held out before us as an unattainable. This series of lessons will not be directed to any particular segment of this congregation. It'll be directed to all of us. To those who are single, who are young and unmarried, the lesson will be directed to you in the prospect that you will discover a real, genuine, successful Christian marriage. But it's not limited to those of you who are unmarried. I'm also directing it to those of us who are married in the hopes that the prospect will be held out to us that not of discovering a successful Christian marriage, but of perhaps recovering that of a successful, happy marriage. Because there are many families in the church, both here and all over the world, there are many families that are being troubled by problems that are threatening to result in divorce for that family. So both those who are single, the prospects of discovering a Christian marriage, and those of us who are married, the prospect of recovering a Christian marriage if our marriage is faltering, this series of lessons is designed to meet the needs of both of these particular groups of people. Both of these prospects are dependent upon our knowing what Jesus Christ taught about marriage. And he taught this in several places. This morning we're going to concentrate our thinking upon one passage, Matthew the 19th chapter, beginning in verse 3. Jesus was approached there by the Pharisees, and they asked him, "Is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause?" He answered, "Have you not read that he who made them from the beginning made them male and female, and said, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one. So they are no longer two, but one. What therefore God has joined together, let no man put asunder. They said to him, why then did Moses command one to give a certificate of divorce and put her away? He said to them, for your hardness of heart, Moses allowed you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for fornication and marries another commits adultery. That's a very clear and profound statement. It's simple, it's to the point. The Pharisees would like to have involved Jesus in a theological wrangle over interpretations presented by some of their scribes, some of their lawyers, some of their theologians. Hillel and Shammai were two theologians of the Jewish nation who held to differing positions as to what were the scriptural bases for divorce and remarriage. And they were tempting Jesus here. I'm confident they were not really concerned about the issue of marriage and divorce. They were trying, it says, to test him, to see if they couldn't hang him up on one of these horns of dilemma regarding the marriage problem. But Jesus didn't allow them to cause him to be tangled up in some of their human reasoning. Jesus pointed them back to the very beginning and said, have you not read that he who made them from the beginning made them male and female? And said, for this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. And they said, well, then why did Moses command to give a writing of divorcement? But Jesus, in all of his discussion, even describing that, as we'll notice in a few moments, goes back to the very issue, the very beginning of the issue, and talks about it from the basis of origins, talks about marriage and divorce from the basis of intentions, from the basis of divine direction, and not from the basis of human innovations or innovations. But we find this subject being discussed by Jesus, and in this passage here, there are two things that I want to call to your attention only this morning, only two things. One of them is that the identical times that existed at that time exist today. That the times that existed at that time, if not being identical, are so similar that it behooves us to look at those times in comparison with ours and see if we can't see what was the situation existing at that time and then look at our times today. And then second, we're going to notice one single quality upon which marriage, a successful marriage, is dependent. First of all, the identical times that prevailed then and now are characterized by two particular aspects. Number one, divorce was easily obtained. There was no stigma against divorce at the time of Jesus Christ. Divorce had become such a commonplace thing in the first century that there was no longer any discussion as to whether or not it should be a matter of conscience or concern. I have some references that I want to give you hurriedly. I'll not spend much time on them, but I do want to give you this as a background. Edward Gibbon states in his Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, when Roman matrons became the equal and voluntary companions of their lords, a new jurisprudence was introduced that marriage, like other partnerships, might be dissolved by the benediction of one of the associates. In three centuries of prosperity and corruption, this principle was enlarged to frequent practice and pernicious abuse. Passion, interest, or caprice suggested daily motives for the dissolution of marriage. A word, a sign, a message, a letter, the mandate of a freedman declared the separation. The most tender of human connections was degraded to a transient society of profit or pleasure. As you listen to these quotations, see how aptly they fit our own generation. Another man in another writing said, in the time of luxury and advanced civilization in which the gospel was first preached, divorce was coming to be looked upon with the utmost indifference as a commonplace fact in ordinary social life. And again, before the end of the Republic, the loss of the belief in the old religion and the growing laxity of morals led to an extraordinary freedom of divorce. And then James Bryce, in a book called Studies in History and Jurisprudence, states that to the Roman of the first century, the marriage bond was even less binding than an ordinary business contract. Another man also states that during the years just prior to the Christian era, freedom of divorce reached such an extreme that some people divorced each other without any grounds and with no ill feeling, but rather with an exchange of presents. I maintain that that is precisely where the American society sits today, or stands, or falls. But I maintain that there is not any difference between the conditions that existed in the first century and those that exist today in the American culture. As a result, I'm confident that the same result that took place in the first century will happen and take place in this century in which we live today. And the same route that the Roman culture took, the American culture will take. How much longer it will take for it to have this effect upon us, I don't know. But I'm confident that no nation of people, having so trampled underfoot the marriage of God, the home that God initiated and that He designed, no nation of people, having trampled underfoot the sanctity of the home, can long survive. We in America have almost, it seems, with impunity, trampled underfoot the home as God designed it, and in short order, I think we're going to be reaping the consequences of it. But that is simply one of the things that is so similar. The divorce rate of the first century and the divorce rate today, where probably in 1976, the divorce rate will exceed 1 million by quite a few hundred thousand. And we'll wait to see. But the divorce rate is so similar that I'm confident that we'll have to look at it in the light of the events of the first century and also not shy away from drawing the same conclusions that that society fell and our society will also fall whenever the undergirding of the society is tampered with and the erosion of the home is just such a tampering of our foundations. But the second thing that's so similar in our time, between our time and their time, is the fact that hardness of the heart is the basic cause for our deterioration of our homes. Jesus, when he pointed out the real cause, he said, "Haven't you heard that God made them from the beginning? And he made them male and female, and he put them together so they could become one." They said, "Well, why then did Moses allow divorce?" Jesus said it was because of the hardness of your heart that Moses allowed divorce to be exercised and to be used. And he pointed them to this hardness of heart. I used to think that this meant hardness of heart toward God. I still believe that's what it means ultimately, and maybe that's what it indicates initially. But I'm confident also that hardness of heart toward God is not the place where this kind of a disruption appears. It doesn't appear to be hardness of heart toward God. I can say this with all truthfulness and in good conscience. I have never counseled a couple who were in trouble in their marriage. I've never counseled a couple yet who looked upon their obstinacy toward each other as a rebellion against God. Never. I've never had anyone, to my knowledge, come to me and identify their problem as being hard-heartedness toward God. The hard-heartedness initially, at least the hard-heartedness practically speaking, doesn't show up as rebellion against God. It doesn't show up as hard-heartedness toward God. It shows up in the hard-heartedness as it relates to the home, around the table, around the playground, around the bed, around the fireplace, around the daily activities of the home, where we find hearts being hardened, one mate against the other mate, where one heart becomes unresponsive, where one heart becomes calloused, where another heart then reacts and becomes unyielding, where there's a lack of this give and take. This is the initial sclerosis of the heart that causes an eventual breakdown of the home. And you can look at it from the viewpoint that it's hardness of heart against God. That's right. But you need not expect people to identify it as that. And you need not expect that to be the place where it comes to light. It'll come to light in these day-to-day activities where your heart as a husband has become calloused and hardened to the needs of your own wife, or where your heart as a wife has been calloused and hardened and has become unresponsive, and the lack of yielding to the needs of the husband. This is where this need, this is where this problem will come to light. And this is where I would identify the real practical thing of hardness of heart. Jesus said it was because of the hardness of your hearts that Moses commanded you to give a writing of divorcement and to put your wives away. And that hardness of heart eventually, of course, must be recognized as a rebellion against God. But I want to warn us Don't think that just because you've not come to the place where you curse God and turn away from Him, that you don't possess a hard heart. If you and I possess the kind of heart that sends our wives or our husbands away from us, if we curse them and send them away without their needs being filled, that's the kind of hardness of heart in which the soil, or that's the kind of soil, that kind of hardness of heart is the soil in which divorce flourishes, and that kills the marriages that we're a part of today. So I think that these two observations will have to be made, that the prevalence of divorce in the first century and the hardness of heart was that which caused divorce to flourish and caused the homes to be destroyed. Hardness of heart today and the prevalence of divorce today and the easy accessibility of divorce are the two things today that cause marriage in the home today to be threatened. Now, the other thing that I want you to notice out of this text here is that upon which marriage can be based. And it's this one simple thing, that of oneness. Oneness. Jesus talks about oneness four times in these two verses, verse 5 and verse 6. When Jesus talks about the home, He talks about oneness in the sense of being an immediate initial action. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife. That initial contact of a man and a woman, where the marriage is consummated, produces a oneness in a very genuine, real way. But He also talks about it in the latter part of verse 5 as being a continuing process. He says, they shall become one, indicating that the oneness is not accomplished by just the initial contact. It's something that is produced over the years in the prospect of a progressive development that brings about a oneness. And yet in verse 6, the first part, He says that it is not something that is always held out ahead of you as being unrealized until life is over. He says they are no longer two, but they are one flesh. He says it is a present reality. And then He talks about the permanent sanctity of it being rooted in the action of God. What therefore God has joined together, let no man put asunder. That's how permanent this oneness is designed to be. So He talks about it in terms of its initial action, its progressive action, its present reality, and then its eternal, timeless entity, or it is an eternal, timeless entity rooted in the identity and the action of God. Now, there are things that promote such oneness. When you talk about the oneness of personality, I can't think of anything more beautiful than two people coming to be one in their thinking, in their actions, in their motives, in their desires. When I think of beautiful things, I think of sunsets and roses and sunrises and many, many beautiful things that God has made. But to save my life, I can't think of a single thing that's more beautiful than two people who come together in companionship involving the total being of both people. I think one of the most beautiful things on earth is a beautiful woman. But I'll do you one better than that. I can't think of a more beautiful thing on earth than a woman, whether she's beautiful or not, a woman approaching motherhood. Now there's the cream on the cake. If there was ever anything more beautiful than a woman approaching motherhood, I don't know what it is. My wife was more beautiful when she was approaching the delivery of our children than at any time in her entire life. And I'm confident that that'll be the way it is until she dies. I think every woman reaches her blooming, her blossom in full when she approaches motherhood. That's just an indication, I think, of what is in store for people, two people. When they come together in a union that produces such beauty as that, there must be something behind it that's genuine and real. When boy meets girl, and the two hearts that at one time beat to separate pulses and to separate beats, when those two meet each other and they start pulsating to a common beat, then watch out. She just literally blossoms. He becomes somebody else. You just never saw what happens when two people, who until that moment have not found the other one, but then they find their other half, they take on new life. She takes on new beauty. He takes on new masculinity. He takes on new, well, whatever it is, responsibility. Everything about them changes and begins to be transformed by the complimenting that the other person does to that person's lack. And I think it's one of the most beautiful things that can happen. Let me read you something. First of all, let me just say that this is true physically, that they become attached to one another. When they look at one another and find a physical attraction, a sexual attraction, it does something to each of them. And may I say this without any reservation, unless you are physically, sexually attracted to someone, don't you dare marry that person. God didn't intend marriage to be a union of eunuchs. He designed marriage to be a union between two people who are physically attracted to each other. And if you want to really foul up your life, marry somebody that you're not attracted to. That's not what marriage is for. Your children will reap the consequences of it. But nevertheless, when you find these two people being attracted to each other physically, sexually, but even more so, the common pulsating that spirits produce when they bring about the force and fiber of mind and heart and emotion and physical union, the body, all this together, brought together, produces this oneness that God intended marriage to be. Marriage is the total commitment of one man to one woman and of one woman to one man. And when that is done, then they become no longer two people. They're one. No longer two destinies. No longer two plans. No longer two ideals. No longer two anything that are conflicting, but they are one. They are now companions, they are partners, they are mates, they are lovers, they are friends. And the name of this new person that is created by these becoming one is the name us, or we, or our. It's no longer you and yours, or I and my and mine and me. But it is, if we're together, if we're married, it's us and our. I think one of the most dangerous places in your marriage will come whenever your marriage begins to reap the consequences of your having decided at some previous time that you're going to go your own way and you're going to have your little world all to yourself. Then you're really in trouble. But when two people come together, as we've noticed, and then give themselves to a lifetime of love, then a union of such beauty and unsurpassed enjoyment results, so much so that it's hard to describe. Here's one man that made an effort. Marital love is a most wonderful thing, for suddenly you're complete. You're one with your wife, and for the first time in your life, you really know her. You live with her from day to day, and soon you realize that she's beautiful, not just physically, but in her real self that you've come to love. You smile at her across the brim of a crowd, and you're thrilled whenever she suddenly appears, and you feel an ache when she's not there. Yours is the happiness from which flows from being able to give of yourself to someone else, of knowing for certain and without any doubt that at last, finally, you belong somewhere. This is the kind of oneness that I'm referring to this morning. But this kind of oneness doesn't come automatically. It doesn't come just because you give somebody a ring, or just because you say, I do, or just because you become physically one with someone. This does not bring about the oneness that we're talking about today. The kind of oneness that Christian marriages are built upon and that result from Christian marriage is the kind of oneness that is built upon God's, equation. God's equation for marriage is this: 1 + 1 + 1 = 1. Not just 1 + 1 = 1. That kind of arithmetic blows your mind also. But this one here is understandable. 1 + 1 + 1 = 1. And if God is that third partner in your marriage, then you can reasonably, without doubt, you can expect your marriage to be a real success and for you to be one with your mate. Christian marriage involves three personalities. It involves your personality as a man, it involves your wife's personality as a wife, and it involves Jesus Christ or God's personality as the prior claim in your marriage. Young people and old alike, may I say this, that no marriage is on safe ground until there is this third partner in the marriage. We think of most triangles in marriage as being detrimental to the marriage relationship. The kind of triangle I'm talking about is an absolute essential if your marriage is to be acceptable and is to be successful. And that marriage is this, that God has to be a part of your marriage. It has to be a part of that triangle. He must be the other part of it. Unless there's a prior commitment by you to God, you're not prepared for marriage. I would never marry someone who loved me more than they loved God. Don't you ever marry anyone that does not love God more than he loves you. And don't you ever marry some woman that does not love God more than she loves you. And I'll tell you what, when a woman loves God more than she loves a man, and then chooses you and says, yes, I want to spend the rest of my life with you, that's the greatest compliment that she can bestow upon you. When a man loves God more than he loves a woman, and yet selects one woman of all others and says, I want you to spend the rest of your life with me. I want to be your mate for the rest of your life. That's the greatest compliment that she can bestow, or that he can bestow upon you as a woman. Unless each one loves God more than the other, there's no real basis for oneness and no real basis for permanency. Marriage is for oneness. At this latest, what was called the Continental Congress on Marriage that just took place in St. Louis last year, one man made this statement, marriage is for oneness. Loving expressed in giving. A great Christian marriage is the unrestricted giving of mind, emotion, body, and will and soul to a mate as if given to Christ. A marriage is most Christian not when it's free from problems and difficulties, but when two persons open themselves to the Spirit of Christ, surrender their wills to Him, commit their lives to Him, and as a conscious dedication, seek to love each other and give themselves to each other as they have been loved and given to by Christ. This is more than making Christ the head of the home. It is the daily, hourly, moment-by-moment willingness to see Christ in your mate and to serve, love, and honor him or her by what we say, do, give, and forgive. He then refers to what he calls the miracle of Christian marriage. The dynamic of it is what he's referring to. The dynamic of Christian marriage occurs when two minds seek the mind of Jesus Christ. Whenever two minds or personalities seek the personality of Jesus Christ, only then do you have something that's definite and tangible. Only then are you able to focus yourselves on something that's outside of yourselves. Only then can you become truly objective. But when a man who has the mind of Christ seeks out a woman who has the mind of Christ, and they too then become one, desiring only to have the mind of Christ in relationship to each other, there cannot help but be oneness in that relationship. That's what we're talking about. This is what we'll be talking about over the next several weeks, and we'll not have further time to develop it this morning. But this is the beauty of Christian marriage. So remember these two things. I think probably the only thing you'll really be able to remember this morning is this equation, 1 plus 1 plus 1 equals 1, and the triangle of which God is the third one. He is the one that must be the third member of your marriage if you're going to have a successful marriage. I wish I could go down the rows today and distinguish between those who are having troubles and those who are not. If we were to put all those on one side who are having problems and all those on the other side who are not having any problems, you know how many people be over here where they're not having any problems? Not any. Not any, really, because all of us have problems. But the answer to the problem is finding Jesus Christ as the one who holds the prior claim in our marriages. This is what makes a Christian marriage. This is what makes a successful marriage. Whenever the will is liberated to deliberately seek Christ's will with a mate, whenever each one then has resigned himself, I'll not do my will anymore. I'm not going to seek what is my will. I'm going to seek what is God's will, and I'm going to seek the personality of Jesus Christ as I relate myself to you as my mate. There is the basis for successful marriage. Today we're being threatened on all sides. The prevalence of divorce, the easiness of acquiring it, the hard-heartedness of this generation toward each other and toward God direly threatens our homes today. The only thing that's going to save us is to get back to the oneness that Jesus mentions in Matthew, the 19th chapter. And that oneness is dependent upon having Christ as the third party of our marriage. What about your homes today? Will you join me today and throughout the next several months and years in praying to God, oh, Father, please help us as we make our homes what you designed them to be? I beg you on behalf of the elders of this congregation, as one who represents their desire that we study this subject for several weeks to come, I beg you on their behalf, I beg you in the name of Jesus Christ, let's be serious and let's get down to brass tacks about our homes. Thank you for that beautiful song, God Give Us Christian Homes, and it expressed it in a beautiful way. Today, our emphasis being upon the home will not detract from that by inviting those who are not Christians to become Christians. But those who are Christians and who are having problems with their homes, would you give yourself to God, and would you determine that by God being my helper, I'm going to see if I can't make my home what God intended for it to be. We urge you to do this. There's no more critical need. Will you commit yourself to it now while we stand and sing?
I bring my sin to thee,